Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 12th of December. Our main stories: India's Parliament has approved a controversial bill that will help refugees from neighbouring countries secure Indian citizenship, but only if they are not Muslim. It's reported that the disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein has reached a settlement with dozens of women who have accused him of sexual harassment or assault. And a militant Islamist attack in Niger has left more than 70 soldiers dead. Also in this podcast:
about 10 years ago, villagers in this faraway part of northern Ethiopia let it be known to archaeologists that they believe there were some kind of ancient buildings and things under the ground.
The ruins of a city dating back more than 2,500 years have been unearthed in Ethiopia. It's been described as a law that discriminates against Muslims in a nation that is supposed to treat all religions equally. The Citizenship Amendment Bill, which has now been passed by both houses of parliament in India, allows people who fled from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan before 2015 to claim Indian citizenship as long as they are not Muslim. The Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi hailed it as a landmark day for India's ethos of compassion and brotherhood. But ahead of the final vote in the upper house of parliament, protesters in Delhi voiced their opposition.
If India is a democratic country, if constitution is guided with no bias to any religion, why should there be a citizenship bill with a particular mention it's only for the non-Muslims? Means Muslims are categorically excluded from it.
Our constitution gives everybody equal rights, not on the basis of religion or caste or creed and anything else. And we, all the citizens, are equal.
After the bill passed, the opposition Congress Party said it was a dark day in India's constitutional history. The law was one of Narendra Modi's election promises. He's been accused of using it to draw attention away from a slowing economy. I spoke to our reporter in Delhi, Pratiksha Gildial, and asked her first to explain the government's reasoning behind the bill.
This is a bill that aims to give citizenship to minorities from neighbouring countries of Pakistan, Afghanistan and Bangladesh, all Islamic countries, Muslim majority countries. So the government says what they are trying to do is give refuge to people who are fleeing these Islamic countries. And therefore, the minorities that are fleeing from there are not Muslims, because these are Muslim majority countries. So if you're a Hindu, Sikh, Jain, Buddhist, Parsi, then you qualify for applying for citizenship, but not if you're Muslim. And that's why Muslims are not a part of this list. This is the government's defence.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of criticism, though. Let's look at the opposition, Congress, which says this marks the victory of narrow-minded and bigoted forces and it will create a divided India. Very strong words.
Indeed, opposition parties have been up in arms. There were heated scenes. There were fiery scenes in Parliament, both in the lower house and the upper house, with many opposition leaders accusing the government of trying to divide India along religious lines. One prominent Muslim leader symbolically even tore a copy of the bill in the Parliament, saying this is unacceptable. And basically, a lot of opposition leaders saying that this is a ploy to marginalize Muslims. And in their eyes, it's a Hindu nationalist government which is trying to make it a Hindu nation. But a huge backlash from outside the opposition parties as well, from campaigners, from activists, from minority groups, from rights groups, who say that faith should not be the consideration for citizenship because India inherently is a secular country.
At the same time, there's also been opposition in northeast India who don't want anybody coming in. People who live there already, they fear that more migrants will come across that border from places like Bangladesh.
Absolutely. A really complex story, this, because on one hand, there are protests about marginalizing Muslims. But in the northeast of the country, the protests are of a slightly different nature. They don't want any migrants to come and settle there, irrespective of their religion, Hindus or Muslims. What they are saying is, because the northeast of India borders countries like Bangladesh, they say that for years they've had a steady influx of illegal migrants who come and settle there, which is changing the demography of the place, which is changing the ethnic makeup of the place, and they don't want that. So that nature of protest, entirely different, but very violent.
Pratiksha Gildial in Delhi. US media are reporting that Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood film producer accused of sexually harassing or assaulting dozens of women, has reached a $25 million civil settlement. Mr. Weinstein also faces criminal charges. He's scheduled to appear in court in January, charged with the sexual assault of two women. Nick Bryant reports.
On a day when a frail-looking Harvey Weinstein appeared for a bail hearing ahead of his criminal trial in the new year, clinging to a walking frame, his lawyers reached a tentative agreement to settle the civil suits against him. More than 30 actresses and former employees have accused him of offences ranging from sexual harassment to rape. But although the women will share a payout under the deal, the disgraced movie mogul will not have to admit to any wrongdoing. Nor, it seems, will he have to pay his accusers out of his own pocket. Instead, the money is expected to come from insurance companies representing his former studio. Given the number of women involved, it's a small payout. But lawyers acting on their behalf evidently thought it was the most they could get.
Nick Bryant in New York. Meanwhile, officials in Jersey City over in New Jersey have suggested that an anti-Semitic motive was behind a shooting at a kosher grocery store on Tuesday night. Six people lost their lives. Neda Taufik has the latest.
The mayor of Jersey City, Stephen Phillips, said that after reviewing footage of the moments before the deadly gun attack, officials believe the kosher grocery was deliberately targeted. They say the two suspects, who have not been identified, bypassed many people and locations on the street, slowly driving towards the market. The suspects then allegedly calmly opened their vehicle doors and began firing with two long rifles. The motive remains unclear, but the mayor suggested anti-Semitism could have played a role. In response to the attack, police in New Jersey as well as in neighboring New York have been dispatched to synagogues and other key locations in the Jewish community.
Neda Taufik. Suspected Islamists have killed more than 70 soldiers at an army base in Niger. It's the deadliest attack there since militant violence erupted in 2015. I heard more from the BBC's Richard Hamilton.
The attack happened on Tuesday night in a town called Inates in the western Tillaberi region, and a statement from the military in Niger said heavily armed terrorists, estimated to number many hundreds, attacked with artillery fire and the use of kamikaze vehicles, and there was sustained shelling and mortar for about 3 hours, and the explosions from ammunition causing fuel tanks to explode were the cause of this very heavy death toll.
3 hours, so it was quite a large-scale attack. But why has Niger become so vulnerable to this kind of assault?
Well, it started, listeners may remember, back in 2012, rebels seized about two-thirds of the north of Mali, and France then deployed troops to try and control the crisis. But it spread because of the porous borders and the vast swathes of the desert in the Sahel region, and it being a very lawless region. The problem spilled into other countries, including Niger, and there's actually a regional security group called the G5, which consists of Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad and Mauritania, and they're actually meeting in France next week to try and do something about this crisis. But the International Crisis Group has warned that people are easily radicalised because what it calls a potent sense of alienation.
Richard Hamilton. A fierce debate is underway in the Cayman Islands over whether to redevelop its main port. The project would initially be paid for by a group that includes the world's two biggest cruise companies, Royal Caribbean and Carnival. Environmentalists fear the new port will cause irreversible damage to the Caribbean territory's prized coral reefs. The issue is to be put to a public vote, as Vivian Nunes reports from Grand Cayman.
It's another busy morning here in the port at Georgetown. hundreds of tourists are disembarking from the small boats that ferry them to and from the enormous cruise ships that are docked in the harbour. The passengers come into the port where there are tour operators trying to attract business. They're offering tours to Seven Mile Beach, Stingray City, snorkel tours. Lots of business being done here. Tourists board the minibuses and are taken off around the island.
The Cayman Islands are a popular destination for Caribbean cruisers, and on most mornings here, towering white ships many stories high roll into the aquamarine waters of Georgetown Harbour. The cruise industry helps employ around 5,000 Caymanians and brings in $200 million a year to government coffers. But there's a problem. The world's two biggest cruise companies, Royal Caribbean and Carnival, have decided they've had enough of the small ferries bringing passengers to shore. Instead, they want to build a large concrete pier to make disembarking quicker and easier. If it goes ahead, it will mean dredging the harbour and destroying 10 acres of coral reef. TJ O'Sullivan is from Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines.
We know that a pier is much better for the guest experience. It allows us to utilize the destination in a much more convenient manner. The guests will come off the ship at a much higher rate. The guests will spend more time in port.
Support our port, support our tourism.
That's an ad sponsored by the Cayman Islands government. It's backing the new cruise berthing facility, but conservationists, marine scientists and local business people are desperately trying to stop it. Nadia Hardy is from the Cayman Islands National Trust.
All this is technically at the moment a protected marine park. It's just absolutely beautiful. It's pristine reef. And for us to sort of envisage destroying 10.3 acres of it is really concerning for the National Trust.
Not far from where the ferries dock, the Margaritaville Bar offers cruise ship passengers relief from the rising temperatures outside. So what do passengers make of plans to build the new pier?
Piers are easy because you just walk off.
But many local tour operators are unconvinced. They say cruise companies already take most of what passengers spend on the island by pre-selling them tours on board the ships. They're worried that by funding the redevelopment of the port, the cruise companies will have even more control of the local tourism sector.
It would be detrimental to the local people.
Detrimental?
It wouldn't be nice. The local people would suffer.
CPR Cayman, a grassroots group leading the campaign against the project, argues that cruise ship passengers bring in just 20% of the island's annual tourism revenue. Far more money comes from the overnight tourists who stay in hotels. Spokesperson Michelle Lockwood says the government should be focusing its efforts on attracting more of those visitors instead of bowing to pressure from the cruise lines.
I think that we have a beautiful island and beautiful, beautiful views that attract that kind of tourist.
Moses Kirkconnell is Deputy Premier of the Cayman Islands.
How do we balance the need of the people for a job and opportunity compared to our environment that we have to protect for the next generation?
Caymanians are expected to vote on the proposal early next year.
That report by Vivian Nunes in Grand Cayman. And still to come on the podcast.
It's one of the world's most sought-after stolen paintings, the 1917 masterpiece Portrait of a Lady by Gustav Klimt.
Tests are being carried out after an item that looks like the missing painting was found inside the wall of the Italian gallery from where it disappeared. The new European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has set out ambitious plans to combat global warming, promising to make the EU climate neutral by 2050.
We do not have all the answers yet. Today is the start of a journey. But this is Europe's man on the moon moment. The European Green Deal is very ambitious, but it will also be very careful in assessing the impact and every single step we're taking.
The plan, which will now be considered by EU leaders and the European Parliament, could eventually see €100 billion allocated to help industry in Europe move away from fossil fuels. Climate change is, of course, having an impact all around the world. And to coincide with the UN Climate Summit in Madrid, we're going to look at efforts to reverse the damage already being done in Tigray province in northern Ethiopia. The area has lost most of its trees, making it vulnerable to drought and intense bursts of rain which wash away the soil. Now the people there are trying to break that vicious circle, turning 1.5 million hectares of land back into forest. The BBC's environment correspondent, Justin Rowlatt, has been to meet the woman leading the restoration.
Driving through northern Ethiopia and you're struck by the stark beauty of this huge landscape. But it is the result of terrible deforestation, all rock and scrub and bare ground. A century ago, trees covered a third of the country. Now it's less than 5%. And without trees, the soils have washed away, leaving the land infertile and vulnerable to climate change. But that is changing.
This is the tree nursery in McAllen University, where we grow seedlings for teaching purposes, experiments, and also planting out for reforestation.
So you use these for reforestation?
Yes, we do. We're seeing seedlings here. These are all indigenous seedlings.
So what trees have we got here? What are these?
This one is the African olive.
An African olive? Does it bear fruit? Does it grow olives?
Yes, it does grow olives. They're much smaller than the European ones.
At a tree nursery at Mekelle University in northern Ethiopia, I meet Sarah Tewolde-Berhan. She's an expert at restoring degraded land.
Some 30, 40 years ago, data shows that droughts were recurring every 10 years. Now they're every 5 years. Who knows what's going to happen next? So we need to prepare as a community, as a society, to be able to function even in drought years. And one of the best ways to do that is to restore environments. And in restored environments, we can capture every little drop of rain that comes.
So that is what, like 12 centimetres?
Yes. So if it's more than 10 centimetres, we would say it's ready for planting. And if there's any root sticking out, we would prune it, which makes it better for dry environments because it grows more lateral roots and it's better adapted that way.
What Sarah and the communities she works with have achieved is really impressive, and you can see it very vividly on this experimental site on the outskirts of Mekelle. So this is degraded land. It's been used as farmland fairly recently, virtually no vegetation. But on the other side of the fence, it's begun to regrow. You can see shrubs, you can see trees, it's greener, and it's way, way lusher. These changes are the results of collaboration with local communities, says Sarah.
Climate change is happening, but we don't just sit around and wait for the devastations to come. As a community, we come together, we do something about it.
She took us to one of the reforested areas.
Down this flat area, and you can see there's a group of trees over there.
The communities agree to keep people and animals out and let the vegetation regrow naturally, she explained. The trees help keep moisture in the soil, recharging rivers and springs.
It may seem very trivial to people who live in wet environments that spring has come back. But for people who live in a dry environment, a spring that was around 100 years ago or 200 years ago is now coming back and giving water is highly significant.
This regreening is happening on a vast scale. We go to places where the trees stretch to the horizon. In this one province in northern Ethiopia, they have reforested 15,000 square kilometres. Tigray experienced a terrible famine in the 1980s. Now, the market stalls are piled high with tomatoes, lettuces, onions and many other crops.
That report by Justin Rowlatt. Well, staying in Ethiopia, and an ancient city dating back to the 8th century BC has been unearthed by archaeologists in the north of the country. Known as Beta Samati, the settlement was part of the powerful Aksum Empire, which once rivaled Rome. Our Africa editor Mary Harper told me more about the discovery.
About 10 years ago, villagers in this faraway part of northern Ethiopia let it be known to archaeologists that they believed there was some kind of ancient buildings and things under the ground. And archaeologists started working on it, and they have announced that they've managed to unearth this ancient town or city, lots and lots of buildings. And they say they've also found what they believe to be a church from the 4th century AD. And an American academic has said that is the oldest known church in Ethiopia and probably in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. So it's a pretty significant discovery.
And this city was inhabited for more than 1,000 years. Tell us about the people who lived there.
Yes, that's what the lead archaeologist says, that it was inhabited for 1,400 years. And he says that that means that it was part of this empire called the Aksum Empire, which is very well known in that part of Africa, but not really known outside. But it also means that it actually predates that. And previously, archaeologists had thought that basically whatever had been there before had crumbled away, and that there was a kind of hiatus between the two civilizations. But now this is shown that actually it was a more of a continuing one. And this was a pretty sophisticated empire, lots of trade with other countries. And it was something that, even though you see these incredible remains in Ethiopia, there's obelisks and things as well nearby in a town called Aksum. You just don't really hear about it outside the Horn of Africa, even though it was obviously very significant.
And what actually can be seen at Better Samati now?
There's lots of buildings, some of which were said to be residential, others to do with commerce and storage.
Made of what?
They're made of stone. And then they found lots of pottery, some of which is inscribed with lettering. They found a stone pendant, which has a cross on it, as well as other symbols. And that has got writing on it that they say is similar to a language in Ethiopia, which is called Giz, which is a language that it's only used now by the religious community. But there's some other very, very ancient churches in Ethiopia where you see this kind of writing.
Our Africa editor, Mary Harper. Not long after the White Island volcano in New Zealand erupted on Monday afternoon, the nearest hospital was overrun with the injured and dying. 3 days on, a total of 8 of the people who were taken off the island have now died. Some 20 people remain critically injured, and the local medical services are stretched. New Zealand's chief medical officer is Dr. Peter Watson.
We currently have supply, but are urgently sourcing additional supplies to meet the demand for dressing and temporary skin grafts. We anticipate we will require an additional 1.2 million square centimetres of skin for the ongoing needs of the patients. These supplies are coming from the United States, and the order has been placed.
I got an update on the injured from our health correspondent, James Gallagher.
Not only have they got burns, some of them will have internal injuries as well, most likely in the mouth and the lungs, because if you're breathing in the same thing that's burning the skin, that causes damage on the inside as well. So let's not think that all of these people are in a particularly good way. Some of them are quite seriously injured.
And the way to treat these burns on the surface is to apply new skin, is that right?
Yeah, in the ideal world, if you had, say you poured a kettle's worth of water over your skin and it caused such severe burns that you need treatment, the ideal treatment would be that you remove the damaged skin and then you would graft skin from elsewhere on your body onto that burn. Now, that's not always possible if you have very extensive burns that cover large parts of your body when there's not enough skin to do it, and that's when you turn to tissue banks. So when you die, and if you're an organ donor, as well as your heart and your kidneys and your corneas and other organs that can be taken, so can your skin. So you can register to be a skin donor when you sign up to an organ donor registry. And that's what happens. So it often comes from the backs of the legs or the actual back itself. It's a very thin layer of skin that's taken. Think of it like when you're sunburnt and your skin starts to peel. That's the amount of skin you're talking about here. And that can then be kept on ice for about 5 years or so. And so then it could be used when it's needed. But there's not enough donated skin in New Zealand, and it's had to turn to other countries.
Yeah, apparently they're asking for 120 square metres of skin from the US. Is that going to be possible?
It should be. That works out. It's about half a tennis court's worth of skin, if you were to, quite a horrific mental image, I accept. But that's the kind of amount that you're talking about. Now, in New Zealand, that's an amount of skin that has clearly exhausted the amount that they have in their tissue banks. But the United States has much larger ones and has a greater supply, as does Australia, where some patients are being moved to for treatment, and also some skin is moving back in the other direction. So this vital resource, really, because you have to think of it as like a living plaster, really, because when you lose your skin, you lose all the protection that comes with your skin. So as well as all the serious illness and danger that these patients are in at the moment, one of the things over the coming days will be the dangers of infection, because your skin is the barrier that stops bacteria and viruses that are out in the environment from getting deep inside your body. And when you have severe wounds, severe burns, then that's a gateway. That's how bacteria can get right into the heart of your body and cause quite serious damage. The the skin and the donated skin is a barrier that helps stop that happening, as well as improving healing and reducing pain.
Our health correspondent, James Gallagher. A painting by the Austrian artist Gustav Klimt, stolen in 1997, may have been found inside the wall of the Italian gallery from where it was taken. Tests are now being carried out on the work called Portrait of a Lady to confirm whether it's authentic. Our Italy correspondent Mark Lowen reports.
It's one of the world's most sought-after stolen paintings, the 1917 masterpiece Portrait of a Lady by Gustav Klimt, valued at more than $65 million. 23 years ago, it disappeared from the gallery in Piacenza where it had hung. The frame was discarded on the roof of the gallery, but the skylight beside it was too small to fit it through, suggesting the frame was planted as a false lead. Now a gardener clearing ivy from a wall of the gallery found a trapdoor and a recess containing a bag, which seemed to hold the painting. Tests are being carried out, but the director of the gallery told Italian media that the stamps and wax behind the picture are original. The condition is excellent, prompting questions as to how long the painting remained hidden in the cavity. Just one of the many mysteries surrounding what really happened to this artistic treasure, long hunted, and now perhaps finally found.
Mark Lowen in Rome. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.